This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the High Yield Cash Account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A High Yield Cash Account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
You know Thing 1 and Thing 2 from Cat in the Hat? That, except for economic news. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 8th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Here is what we are going to do on day 160 of the Great Trade War of 2018. That's counting, by the way, from the day President Trump first announced them.
It'll be 25% for steel. It'll be 10% for aluminum.
Seems like a long time ago, right? We are going to pull together two things, if you will, from the way we have been covering this economy and apply them to the trade war news of the day, which is announcements from Beijing and Washington of yet another round of mutually reciprocal taxes on each other's imported goods. The first thing, thing one, comes from a series we've been doing called My Economy, the through line of which is that, hey, economic headlines are all well and good, right? But what really counts in this economy is how people are feeling in their own day to day. So hang on to that, thing one, while you listen to this. The president's chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, in his office the other day with thing two. He was responding to me, telling him that what we're hearing from a lot of people we talk to is that the pain they are feeling out there is real and they just want the tariffs to stop.
You know, I appreciate the concern. Absolutely. But I will say, so far, the pain has been de minimis, really very little.
De minimis is what he said. They're on a macro level, really very little. The thing is, both of those things can be and are right now true. But the longer this trade war goes on, the more pain people are going to feel in their day-to-day. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson starts us off.
Go to the doctor with some ailment. You'll likely get the question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad's the pain?
I think right now you're probably a 5.
Randy Sprock is a pork producer in Minnesota. He also works with the U.S. Meat Export Federation.
And I think it's going to get more painful the longer we go. I'd say it's going to be a 10 this fall.
Pork is one of the products China's targeted with retaliatory tariffs. It's China's sorghum tariffs that are hurting Texas farmer Scott Frazier.
We're probably looking at a 7 or 8. I mean, it's serious.
Sorghum is mainly used to feed livestock. And Frazier says the price he can sell it for has dropped about 20%.
Our margins are very, very small, so that's pretty hard to make up just to trim in cost.
Agriculture, some manufacturing, this is where the tariff pain is most acute, says Chad Bown with the Peterson Institute.
While in the immediate term, it may not show up as big GDP effects or not cause a recession or something like that, it certainly does impact local communities.
President Trump has announced up to $12 billion in aid for farmers affected by the tariffs. But Bounce says the bigger hit could come from the uncertainty over how or when these trade tensions might be resolved.
A lot of companies now, they don't know what markets are going to be available to them. Are they going to be able to produce in the United States and sell to China?
There's no light at the end of the tunnel for companies, at least not yet. The White House says talks with China are ongoing, but neither side seems ready to blink. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
You know how we know how people are feeling about this trade war? We call them up and we ask them. We call Austin Golding on a pretty much regular basis. He runs the family business, Golding Barge Lines, down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Austin, good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai, great to talk to you again.
Think big picture for me with all the news of the economy and tariffs and trade and you being a guy who's kind of at the intersection of what goes up and down the Mississippi River, which is heavily trade dependent. How you feeling?
I feel cautiously optimistic right now. I think as long as the economy is rolling, we are a beneficiary and we'll see our volumes stay the same. And then kind of the more physical side, I think what our industry is seeing affect us the most is steel prices. What we operate is made of steel, boats, barges. As steel speculation and steel prices increase, it's definitely going to limit expansion, new construction, and it does increase the value of the fleet in this country now.
Yeah.
But as steel prices go up, repair and construction costs in our industry rise with them.
Yeah, so let's say you had to go out and buy a new barge or a new tug or whatever you got to do, and you have to make that capital expenditure. Would you think twice?
I absolutely would. That being said, there is some equipment out there now that as those economics come into play, it makes older equipment more attractive now. You can actually afford to put more money into older equipment. And also in the new tax law, you can enjoy the full depreciated value of used equipment in the first year. So retrofitting could have an increase, or the life of existing equipment could be extended.
How are you feeling about, I don't know, next year, 18 months?
Well, that's a great question, Kai, because I think right now we're looking at a year out, 18 months out, of what these impacts could be. And I think obviously the largest sector that could be impacted is the agri sector of our business.
Yeah.
Now, if these trade tariffs cause a huge recession within the agribusiness, you're going to see volumes in the river decrease. Kai, our game is anything northbound is headed to market. Anything southbound, for the most part, is headed for the world market.
Huh.
And if we eliminate the world market, our southbound cargoes are going to be really affected. Three sectors that we see now that have the volumes are increasing substantially outside the agribusiness are coal, ethanol, and frac sand, all related to energy industry.
Sure, of course, because that's where the president wants to devote his energy policy. That makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Absolutely.
Huh. Before I let you go, let me get a reality check, would you, on how much people outside the news business are paying attention to the trade and economic news. I mean, when you go down to the general store in Vicksburg, or you go to the Target or a cup of coffee or whatever, I mean, is it top of mind, or are you guys worried about other things?
No, I think it's absolutely top of mind in our part of the world. We have a huge agricultural economy in Mississippi, a huge agricultural economy along the river, and we see this as a very treacherous negotiation. Most people are optimistic, but I don't think they might be as optimistic as the administration thinks, and I don't think they're all doom and gloom like maybe some people outside of their world think. They're used to volatility in the agribusiness. These guys are survivors. And I think that they're looking for their way to survive. And I don't think they're looking for a subsidy. I think they're looking for their angle. They're looking for their market. And if it's not there, they'll be the first ones to stand up and say, we've been unfairly cornered.
Huh. Austin Golling at Golling Barge Lines in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Thanks for the time, man. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Kai. Thank you.
On Wall Street today, low volume, not too much movement. Why, yes. Yes, it is the middle of August. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The White House reimposed economic sanctions against Iran this week. Tehran is being gradually shut out of bigger and bigger chunks of the global economy. Cars, precious metals, more functional metals as well, steel and aluminum. Also, the foreign exchange markets. They can't buy or sell dollars anymore. But as big a deal as that is, the sanctions are going to get bigger in November come oil. Or in the more clinical language of the executive order, sanctions on the purchase of petroleum products, or petrochemical products from Iran. The Trump administration says, in fact, it wants exactly zero barrels of Iranian oil out on the global market. Is that likely? Not likely? And oh, by the way, what's it going to mean for you and me at the pump? From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
Rural Virginia is half a world away from the oil fields of Iran and energy geopolitics. But a lot of people here seem to care. At the farmer's market in the town of Culpeper, about 70 miles from D.C., several merchants are cheering U.S. sanctions against Tehran.
Iran is a country that scares me with what they're doing.
Hannah Jackson has a booth here. She sells meals for delivery.
Sanctions on them to let them know that we're serious, you know, is something we need to do.
That could affect world oil supply and gas prices. And Jackson is aware. She's always on the road and gasses up her pickup truck about twice a week.
It's about $100 a week.
Okay.
And then I have another car that I fill up at least once, and that's around $40.
Here's how sanctions might go. Iran exports about 2.5 million barrels of crude every day, and the Trump administration wants to choke that down to zero. Most analysts find that unrealistic, because oil tends to seep through the cracks of sanctions. That's happened with past sanctions against Iran and Iraq. This time around, two countries have already announced plans to keep buying. That is the national anthem of China. Here's how it could pull it off. The sanctions identify banks around the world involved in Iranian oil sales. The U.S. insists any bank continuing to do those deals would be cut off from future international business. But that would not hurt Chinese banks that mostly do business inside China. They won't be deterred, says Middle East energy analyst Ellen Wald of Transversal Consulting.
There is at least one bank that does seem to do that, the Bank of Kunlun. That bank was active in the last previous round of sanctions in financing purchases of Iranian oil.
That's China's evasion. Now, the other big country planning to buy Iranian crude? Iran's neighbor of Turkey. Iranian sellers could do discreet deals there with, say, short-haul tanker deliveries.
It is also possible for Iran to truck its oil across the border to Turkey, and that would be much harder for the U.S. to track.
And then there's the type of oil export known in the trade is cheating. Sarah Vakshri runs the consultancy SVB Energy International.
Well, there's many ways to cheat.
Iranian oil can be blended in with other liquid exports that are not sanctioned. Iran's tanker ships can turn off their geotransponders at sea. Or they can make secret hookups with other ships, Vakshri says.
So basically sell your oil to another ship on the sea. It's not very easy to track all the ships around the world and see if for like some hours these two ships were connected through pipe.
Despite all that, she thinks Iranian exports would still fall by a good amount, since key buyers in Europe and Japan are already seeking alternate suppliers. And this would mean less total oil supply in the world. Now, other producing countries can make up that shortfall of perhaps 1.5 million barrels per day, but in doing so, that would leave precious little spare oil for emergencies, say a pipeline explosion or turmoil in Venezuela.
That will have a significant impact on psychology of the traders, and if market at any time has any indication or scenario of interruption in the future, that would have impact on the current price.
So, more risk for higher oil and gas prices. Back at the farmer's market in Culpeper, Virginia, are the long-distance drivers with their pickups, are they okay with that? Tom Henneman manages the market.
That's a good question. It depends how high the price of gasoline would go. If it goes up, you know, 10 cents a gallon, it's worth it. If it goes up $2.50 a gallon, it may not be worth it.
Any impact on gas prices could come at an interesting political moment. The oil sanctions on Iran take full effect November 4th, 2 days before the midterm elections. In Culpeper, Virginia, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's hard to believe that he simply forgot about $10 million.
But that is his story, and he's sticking to it. First, though, let's do the numbers. As I said, kind of boring on Wall Street today. Dow Industrial's down 0.2%, 45 points, 25,538. S&P 500 basically flat. NASDAQ as well, basically flat. Pharmacy chain CVS reported higher quarterly revenue today. Investors loaded up their baskets. Shares popped up 0.4%. Drug maker Mylan, the supplier of EpiPens, saw quarterly revenue fall due to declining sales in North America. Didn't seem to hurt too much. Shares buzzed up about 0.8% today. Over in the tech world, growing worries over U.S.-China trade tensions helped weigh down chipmaker Qualcomm. Shares powered down 0.4%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
I'm Shepard from Lincoln, Nebraska, and
I listen to Marketplace several times, actually, every day, because it's got the economic news and developments that are important to me. I donate to Marketplace so that it can be available to everyone, and I hope you'll join me in this effort. Thanks.
To join Shepherd as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are now plus or minus 30 hours past Elon Musk's tweet yesterday that he is going to take Tesla private and that he's got the financing lined up to do it. There has so far been no showing of the money, so markets and analysts are kind of having to take Musk's word for it, which leaves this story still firmly in the category of if it happens. But if it does, it would be a biggie. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, there are some real, as in actual, financial costs and benefits for him to consider.
Public companies like Tesla deal with a lot of pressure. There's a relentless focus on short-term results, which can squash long-term plans. Short sellers betting against your company. Shareholders that can bail if you have a bad day.
Well, that puts the company under a different level of scrutiny than the company would have as a private company.
That's Donna Hittrich at the Columbia Business School. Tesla's had its share of issues meeting production deadlines and raising the cash needed to run the business. Stephen Davidoff Solomon is a professor at UC Berkeley's Law School.
Clearly, Elon Musk is feeling the pressure of the public lights on him.
He says Musk would escape from some of that pressure by going private. But finding the cash for a buyout won't be simple.
This is not something you can just go to the country club and hand out a hat and raise the money.
Musk says he secured the funding he needs, but private money has its own strings. Nicole Boyson is a finance professor at Northeastern University.
Presumably, he's still going to have some creditors in there that he's going to have to answer to.
That can include private equity firms, hedge funds, even sovereign wealth funds. Boyson says those investors have been eager to lend to private companies lately.
You've seen private markets willing to step in and provide funding to such a large degree that there was some talk a few years ago about, you know, maybe there won't be many more IPOs.
The number of IPOs has declined in the U.S. Boyson says companies like Uber and Dropbox have chosen to stay private, given that cash has been so easy to come by. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
For those wondering, by the way, whether Musk can just tweet out something that bumps share prices 11%, as his tweet did yesterday, maybe not. Late this afternoon, Dow Jones Newswires reported the Securities and Exchange Commission has made, quote, inquiries to the company about whether Musk's statement was truthful and why it was made on Twitter. Shares off 2.4% today. There was a time in this economy, not all that long ago, really, when you had to pay to see your credit score, and you kind of had to do it every now and then because you were trying to qualify for a mortgage or maybe you'd been turned down for something. Now, though, it seems everybody and their grandma want you to check your credit score all the time, even your bank, and it's free. But why? Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
If you have a Chase credit card, and there are millions of you out there, you may have received an email like this. Dear so-and-so, sign in to Chase Credit Journey now to review your credit score and a complete history of your recent alerts. That's right. Chase wants you to journey through your credit history for free. And Chase isn't the only one.
Oh my gosh, it seems like every month I've got three or four emails telling me that my credit score is updated and it's time to check it.
Nick Zahn is a geologist with the state of Maryland. He says those emails come from
my credit card companies, from my bank occasionally, and of course all the financial firms like Mint, Intuit, and Credit Karma. They're all coming after me.
To understand how we got here, we need to go back to when credit scoring really took off. All the way back to the 1980s.
It was the mad scientists in the bank headquarters competing against the relationship banker in the branch.
Nick Clements is co-founder of the financial education site Magnify Money and former director of risk management at Citigroup. He says the data scientists thought they could measure credit risk better than the branch bankers who knew their customers, and they were right.
Sadly, we are rather predictable when it comes to our credit behavior, and scoring models were more effective than one-off conversations.
Those models were secret, lest customers try to cheat the system by, say, falsifying their employment history or salary. But as that information got easier to verify and credit scores were more widely used, Clements says the secrecy no longer made sense. Then in the 2000s, fintech companies like Credit Karma saw a business opportunity in giving away credit scores for free.
Better credit scores give you better options, like a new loan. If you find that loan on Credit Karma, your lender pays us.
And so it actually became, to a certain extent, a strategic threat to some of the banks, and they decided that they needed to get into this education game as well.
And now banks are playing catch-up. Katherine Hogan is president of Chase Branded Cards. She says the bank first offered free credit scores to certain card customers a few years ago and recently expanded the service to everyone, even non-customers.
We know there are over 100 million people in the country who are considered prime borrowers. And so we are hopeful that providing, you know, these tools may help more people decide to become Chase customers.
She says millions of current customers have signed up for Credit Journey since it launched. Once they're on the journey, Chase can sell them other products. And there's another benefit to banks, says Christopher Peterson. He's Financial Services Director at the Consumer Federation of America. Banks are liable for unauthorized charges.
And by providing these services free or packaging them along with a credit card, banks can give the consumer a way to monitor whether or not they've been exposed to an identity theft.
So is all this messaging working? Peterson's group says about 57% of adults have accessed their credit score in the past year, up from about 50% 4 years ago. Nick Zahn says the reminders are prompting him to check his credit more. Though he doesn't pay much attention to whose website he uses.
It really doesn't matter to me.
And he says he hasn't signed up for any new offers either. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, is spending more time than usual in the spotlight for a Commerce Secretary. Trade wars tend to do that, one supposes. But before Ross was negotiating American trade policy with the rest of the global economy, he was a businessman, a successful one, too, worth at one point, he claimed, $2.5 billion. Government disclosure forms later revealed Ross's net worth to be closer to $700 million. But he's also the subject of a new story in Forbes magazine about some less savory aspects of his business practices. Dan Alexander had the byline. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm thinking maybe the first thing we ought to do is remind people what Wilbur Ross did before he was in government, right? Because that's kind of germane to this article.
Well, he got very rich by distressed asset investing. You know, he was a private equity manager who had made a lot of great deals in the steel industry and then had done some decent deals in a couple other industries. And then he got to his billionaire status by apparently lying to us about how much he was worth.
Which gets us to this piece and some of the, you know, questionable conduct, I suppose, that the Secretary has engaged in both before and since he's been in government. Lay out sort of the elevator pitch here for me.
So basically, there have been a number of lawsuits and settlements and an SEC fine that point to a pattern. And the pattern is that Wilbur Ross has allegedly stolen millions of dollars from the people who he worked with, including one of them is his right-hand man, longtime right-hand man, and siphoned tens of millions of dollars from the people who invested with his firm. If you add up all the allegations, you get to more than $120 million, which is a remarkable amount of money for anyone.
The question, of course, has to be, why is a guy who has said he is worth billions, but turns out is worth mere hundreds of millions. Why do you suppose he is engaging in this kind of behavior, allegedly?
You know, I talked to a lot of people and asked a lot of people that very question who worked with him or who had invested with him. And basically the picture that you get is this is a guy who sort of can't stop. You know, one person who worked with him told me he's a pathological liar in those words. You know, they told me stories of him going down to the restaurant underneath the office and stealing a bunch of Sweet and Low packets and bringing them back up to the office so that then he wouldn't have to go out and buy any for himself.
We should say here, we have called the secretary's office for comment on this interview, and you obviously called him for comment on the piece. What did he say to you?
So what they said to me at the time before we published was basically they were highlighting the fact that Secretary Ross has not personally been charged by any regulatory agencies. That is true. However, his firm, which he was at the head of, and this is a firm that he really dominated. It's not like a public company where he's a CEO. You know, this is his shop. Did pay an SEC fine and was under SEC regulation and scrutiny for years. And the charges from his former partners and investors are against him personally.
Apart from these alleged thefts and misdeeds in this piece, there's also, which predate his time in government, there's also been some issues with the secretary in terms of divesting his holdings and not being completely forthcoming with that and filing amended returns and many other defects, I suppose you could say, with what he has said he is going to do and what he has actually done.
That's right. You know, maybe the most glaring one is that last November he said that he had divested all of the assets that he had promised that he was going to divest when he had not. There were a couple of assets that he still held on to, but Ross's response has been, you know, that it was just a mistake and I didn't realize that I own the shares. But for a guy who's one of the most sophisticated investors in the country, it's hard to believe that he simply forgot about $10 million.
Dan Alexander writing in Forbes magazine about Wilbur Ross, Secretary of Commerce. Dan, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We did wind up getting a statement from Commerce about Dan's article. It reads in part, "The baseless claims made in this story were well publicized long ago and are not news." Final note on the way out today, which will be the first and only mention of pumpkin spice latte that passes my lips this season, but it is popular, so consider this a public service announcement. From Business Insider this afternoon, this item, fans of the drink, some of whom work at Starbucks, I guess, have started posting pictures of PSL supplies in stores. Consensus estimates are that it'll be available to consumers, should you be among the faithful, August the 28th. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial shed 0.2% today, 45 points. S&P 500 and the NASDAQ both basically flat. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.